From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. His film The Woodsman is now out on DVD. After serving 12 years for molesting young girls, his character has just been released from prison and is trying to start a new life and control his impulses. We'll talk with Bacon about The Woodsman and his other work on the big screen, including Mystic River, Animal House, and Footloose, and about his early life growing up in Philadelphia, where his father headed the City Planning Commission. Also, the early days of Motown. Rock historian Ed Ward takes us there. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Kevin Bacon, is the star of a famously diverse string of movies. The latest of them is The Woodsman, which is out now on DVD. In The Woodsman, Bacon plays a sex offender who has just gotten out of prison after serving 12 years for molesting young girls. The movie follows him as he tries to re-enter society and keep control of his own impulses. Bacon got his start in teen movies like Footloose and Diner. He's since starred in many films, including Apollo 13, Murder in the First, The River Wild, and Mystic River. Terry spoke with Kevin Bacon earlier this year to discuss his wide range of movie roles. They started with a short scene from The Woodsman. Bacon's character Walter is meeting with his psychiatrist and has confided that he just followed a young girl into a shopping mall, but didn't approach her or talk with her.
What did you think would happen?
I don't know.
What did you want to happen?
I don't know. Would you please stop writing in the f***ing pad? You know that if anything happens to me, I go back to prison, no parole, no nothing, for life.
Is this the first one?
Of course it is. Why do you think I'm telling you?
I want you to calm down. You followed a girl. Perhaps you wanted to see what it felt like after so many years. Maybe subconsciously you were testing yourself. And here you are, talking about it with me. This is positive. Walter will pick up here next week.
Remember when you asked me what my idea of normal was? Normal is when I can see a girl, be near a girl, even talk to a girl, and not think about it. It's my idea of normal.
Terry asked Kevin Bacon about preparing for his role in The Woodsman.
You know, I didn't spend time hanging out with child molesters. I did do a lot of reading and a lot of research. There's a lot of research that the director had done about people that have this affliction, but it was important for me to make him an everyman, because one of the things that's most frightening about this sickness is that it cuts across all kind of, you know, racial, socioeconomic, even international boundaries. You cannot look at a crowd of people and pick out the sex offender. So it was important for me to make Walter an everyman.
Now, you're dealing with a character who knows his impulses are wrong. He understands that. But knowing that they're wrong doesn't make them any less strong. And so throughout the movie, your character is fighting his impulses. And even, you know, whether he's in an area where there's a child inside or not, he's keeping himself in check. And that's constantly registering on your face. It's a very kind of withdrawn, introverted performance, because you're always, aside from a couple of moments, you're always holding back and holding it in. Can you talk a little bit about doing that?
I think that the driving force for me is shame. He's a very shameful character. And I think that all of us have things in our life that we can feel ashamed of. You know, you have to go to work and take that shame and put it in your gut every day and make sure that you keep staying in touch with it and hope that it comes out through your eyes. I think that it has to be there in any kind of situation. Like, for instance, if I look on a schedule and I see that there's a day where I'm just riding the bus all day, you know, normally in a movie you go, oh, that's going to be an easy day, you know. I don't have to beat anybody up. I don't have to cry. I don't have to, you know, yell and scream, you know. I'm just riding on the bus. But they're all hard, because it's a day he's riding on the bus with a lot of shame, you know. It's got to be there all the time in everything that he does, walks and talks and, you know, sits there and eats a bowl of cereal, you know. I've felt really strongly that I wanted Walter to be a person that we would see how he was feeling rather than hear how he was feeling. There are, just like in life, there's people who are more verbose or demonstrative, where they're hard on their sleeve, you know. Walter is someone who is trying to disappear. He spent 12 years in prison, and to be a child molester in prison is the lowest person on the totem pole, and it would make someone want to hide.
The one character in the movie who is really kind of sympathetic toward you and understanding of you is a woman who you work with, who's played by your real wife, Kira Sedgwick. And I'm wondering what it's like to work with someone who you actually know really intimately, and you have to be in this acting situation where you're getting to know each other. Of course, the people you're getting to know aren't who you really are. But no one knows you better than a spouse. Mm-hmm. So is it harder to establish these characters who are mysteries to each other?
Well, it's a difficult acting exercise because you have to erase 16 years of marriage and 16 years of familiarity. So often, as actors, we're asked to do the exact opposite. I can't tell you how many times I've met somebody in, you know, at 6:30 in the morning in the makeup trailer, and they say, "Okay, she's playing your mother."
Right.
And then, you know, half an hour later, you're on the set, and you have to bring everything, all the complexities of that relationship, to this complete stranger. You have no relationship with it at all, and no history with it. It's difficult. And this is like the opposite problem. We have to kind of erase the history.
And what happens when the movie's over? You know, I hear so much from actors that it's hard sometimes to shake a character. That might be particularly true when you're playing a pedophile like you are in The Woodsman. And then you go home with the main character who you're acting opposite, who is your wife. And so if you stayed in character at all when you got home, or if the roles kind of came home with you, that would really be a problem.
Yeah. Well, I can say that people have sort of looked sometimes mistakenly at the idea of the two of us working together, that it would somehow make the process easier for either one of us emotionally. And it couldn't be farther from the truth. I mean, the fact is that when you have two people that are actors, in our case, what we tend to do is I'll go to work and she becomes kind of a support system, you know, for me in terms of taking care of the kids and the house and being a shoulder to cry on. Then she goes to work, and I take over that job, and I become the support system for her. When we're both working together, we're really not there so much for each other as husband and wife. And so it is difficult. In terms of leaving it at home, you know, I did a movie called Murder in the First, where I was playing this prisoner, and I was getting beaten and shackled, and I was covered in bugs and dirt, and I'd lost a whole bunch of weight, and it was in a very, very dark space emotionally, similar kind of space to where I was when I was doing The Woodsman. But I have this picture of me about 2 days after I wrapped the picture, and I'm on a beach in Hawaii, and my head's shaved, and I'm still gaunt and pale, but I'm holding my little girl, and you can see on my face that guy is behind me, that it couldn't be farther from my thoughts. So it's not so much that I carry it over as it is I know that I have to go back into that place the next morning. That's the thing that's difficult. Not leaving it behind is about knowing what's ahead of you. So on Friday night, you know, when you wrap on a Friday night and you have a beer, you know that Monday morning I got to be Walter again. And so it makes the weekend, you know, a little bit rough.
Kevin Bacon, speaking with Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're listening back to Terry Gross's interview with Kevin Bacon. Let's hear a scene from his acclaimed 2003 film, Mystic River. He plays a state trooper, investigating the murder of a young woman who was the daughter of his childhood friend. Here, he's questioning a couple of the girls' friends.
You guys were having a goodbye dinner, right?
What?
Well, she was leaving town, wasn't she? Going to Las Vegas.
How do you know?
She closed her bank account. She had hotel phone numbers.
She wanted out of this dump. She wanted to start a new life.
Well, a 19-year-old girl doesn't go to Las Vegas alone, so who is she going with? Come on, girls. Who is she going with?
Brendan.
Excuse me?
Brendan.
Brendan Harris?
Brendan Harris, yeah.
Now, Mystic River was directed by Clint Eastwood. I just saw him on the Actors Studio on Bravo, the series in which he's of interviews with actors and directors. And he said in his interview that he likes to have a very quiet set, and that some actors, some directors like to holler, action, but he likes to say, okay, we'll start the scene now.
Or okay,
just say
you guys, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, is that what it was like?
That's what he says, yeah. Okay, he says, and then when he says cut, he goes, that's enough of that.
Does that work for you to not have like the clanging what do you call it, the clanging slate, and to not have somebody crying action? Did it make a difference?
It makes a huge difference. You know, a long time ago, actually, when I was working with John Hughes, I came to the realization that part of the setup for movies is to create this very, very tense time between action and cut, which is the time when things should be the most relaxed. It's when an actor should be the most relaxed. And, you know, what happens is you've been thinking as an actor all day about what you're going to do, and someone pounds on your door and gives you a 10-minute warning, and then they give you a 5-minute warning. Then they say, okay, we're ready for you. And you're already getting nervous, like you're going to jump out of a helicopter, you know, into the Mekong Delta or something. And now you're on the set, and people start screaming, quiet, quiet, cell phones off, quiet, rolling, speed. Mark, the sound guy, is usually so far away that he's screaming, you know, when he's got speed on the knocker. And then the guy hits the slate, and you're like a deer in the headlights. And now you got to act. And then you say, cut. And all the tension goes out of the room, and everyone's on the phone, and they're talking about lunch, and that. When Clint was doing television, westerns, he realized that he'd get six horses lined up, and so they would start screaming, and they'd hit the slate, and the horses would all take off. And he figured that if that was true for horses, it's got to be the same for actors. So he has no open walkie-talkies. And the camera assistant just barely taps the slate. He doesn't say action. So instead of jumping into some kind of acting head, you just are there, and you just inhabit the scene. And then you inhabit your way out of the scene, and you do another take. And it becomes the actor's time, as opposed to, you know, we only have these 10-second bits that are about us. And it's very, very helpful and very, very powerful.
Is he a non-intrusive director in other ways, too?
He's very non-intrusive, yeah. You know, he does not rehearse. He doesn't give you, you know, long kind of suggestions about your character. You know, I was playing a state trooper, and I had to go out and, you know, find some state troopers to ride around with. You know, it's not like, you know, he demanded that of me. I worked on a Boston dialect that I worked on by myself. There was no machine in place to, you know, kind of take care of that.
Should there have been one?
No. I mean, I feel like I like to do my own homework, you know. Mm-hmm. I come to the set having made very clear decisions. I'll ask a director for suggestions if I feel like I need them, and I'm certainly willing to hear them, or I'm open to any kind of input. But, you know, I also want to go away and figure out who my guy is and come ready to go. And I think all of us kind of knew that was the drill with Clint. And so all of us came wearing our game jerseys and, you know, we were ready to step up to the plate. That's sort of what you want to do for him, you know. And that works really well for me because I don't discover my character in the course of between, you know, take two and take 25. You know, I know who he is, and I also don't want to talk about it that much. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't need to discuss it. And
does it make it too schematic if you do?
Well, I think it can. I don't know. I think it can get in the way. You know, that's not to say that there aren't directors that I've worked with that have been helpful, but honestly, there haven't been many times where someone has come over. And this is, I think, generally the public's perception of the great director is the guy who comes over and whispers some gem of a piece of information in the actor's ear, and all of a sudden, you know, they're Sophie's Choice. You know what I mean? I think that's not usually the case.
Can you pinpoint a time where you realized you were no longer like the teen star or the new young star, that you were established and you were like a full-fledged adult, not only in person, but in terms of the kind of roles you were going to get?
Well, no, I can't really pinpoint a time. I mean, I think it's kind of a process. I mean, there have been moments in my career that have felt like a turning point. Certainly, you know, Footloose, you know, obviously changed kind of the landscape for me in a way that I was not really all that comfortable with, frankly. I mean, I thought I was ready for it, but I really wasn't. And in a lot of ways, I sort of rejected that kind of stardom. And all of a sudden, I didn't really want to be on magazines, and I didn't really want to, you know, sign autographs. And
why not? Everybody, so many actors seem to really want, in addition to good roles, they want the fame.
I know. I have to say that I always have said that there's two kinds of actors: actors that want to be famous and liars. You don't go into this business because you want to fade into the background.
Right.
That's not the nature of an actor. It was just that kind of pop stardom is not the kind of stardom that I was looking for. I wanted to be, you know, a legitimate New York, you know, actor. You know, I don't
admired
know.
for the craft and the dramatic right, like, roles, not like he's cute. He's
exactly,
cute.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. And now I was, you know, on the cover of whatever Tiger Beat, and, you know, all
right,
that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I rejected that in my own way, and was kind of spinning my wheels for a long time,
mm-hmm.
many years. A lot of movies that I believed in that didn't pan out, and then, you know, I'd sort of go into independent films and smaller films, and they weren't seeming to break out. And doing some plays, but JFK was a movie that really turned things around for me, because I worked for 4 days on the movie, and it was a very extreme characterization of this kind of fascist, gay sociopath, the movie came out, and the phone started to ring. It started to lead the way to much more serious and complex and kind of edgier sort of stuff, and it was a great turning point for me.
My guest is Kevin Bacon. I hope you don't mind my asking this, but when was the first time, because you're probably tired of talking about it, when was the first time you found out about the existence of the game 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon?
I don't remember the first time, but I do remember that, you know, it was a long time ago. I mean, it's been around a really long time.
Right.
At least 10 years, 15 years, I don't know. And people would say to me, I played this drinking game the other day, and, you know, you had to take a shot of booze every time for every degree of separation from you.
I didn't know that was part of it.
Yeah, or they said, a friend of mine's cousin came up with a game about you, you know. I mean, a lot of very, like, diverse kind of things. And then it was one of the first things that really spread on the internet.
Oh.
You know, it was really the beginning of I'm not saying the game started the internet, but when the internet really started to begin, we weren't used to these kind of concepts that exponentially, you know, would spread. And Six Degrees was like that. People started talking about it and playing it. It was actually started by these guys down in, I think it's the University of Virginia or something like that. They were sitting around in their college dorm room and came up with this concept. A movie of mine was on the TV. And Jon Stewart used to have a show, he had a nighttime show. And he had those guys on. And, you know, I remember going to the show with my publicist, and he was like, okay, you know, I hope you're not too freaked out about this, but those guys that, you know, say they came up with the game are, you know, going to be on there. And I thought it was a joke at my expense. That's the way I perceived it, being, you know, having a bout of low self-esteem. You know, I thought, well, the idea is that, you know, they say, can you believe that this jackass can be connected to Marlon Brando or, you know, Laurence Olivier or something like that? You know, isn't that ironic? I thought that was kind of the joke. When I actually met the guys, that wasn't true. I mean, they actually were, you know, fans of the movies and stuff like that.
Kevin Bacon speaking with Terry Gross in January. His film The Woodsman is out on DVD. We'll hear more with Kevin Bacon in the second half of the show. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Locked Rooms, a new novel of suspense by Laurie R. King featuring Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, finding out that Footloose was a dance movie. We continue our conversation with Kevin Bacon. Also, the first two hits out of Motown Records. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us what they were. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross, back with Terry's interview with Kevin Bacon. His film The Woodsman is out now on DVD. In 1984, the film Footloose made Kevin Bacon a star. He played a city boy who moves with his family to a small town where rock music and public dancing are banned. In this scene, Bacon's character, Ren McCormick, is asking the town council to allow his high school to have a dance. The minister has strongly opposed the idea. Ren decides to beat him at his own game by turning to the Bible.
And it was King David. King David, who we read about in Samuel. And what did David do? David danced before the Lord with all his might, leaping, leaping and dancing before the Lord. Leaping and dancing. And Ecclesiastes assures us that there is a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to laugh and a time to weep. A time to mourn. And there is a time to dance.
Let me ask you about Footloose. The role that you played was so different, I think, than who you were and what your life had been. You grew up in the city. This is about a kid who lives, you know, moves to a small town. The preacher hates dancing and frivolity. Mm-hmm. And you, of course, teach the kids how to dance. Mm-hmm. and you have to dance in it. And it's such a teen film. And you'd been, I think, like the youngest actor in Circle in the Square, a kind of long respected theater company in Greenwich Village. I mean, the sensibilities seem like so different. Did you feel like you were cast in a movie that was almost alien to what you knew?
Well, yeah. I mean, first off, I was about 23, I think, or 24 when I did the movie.
Which is about 5 years older than your character?
Yeah, yeah. So playing a high school kid, you know, it was a little bit difficult for me. I felt like I was so kind of beyond high school in my mind. And I'd been living essentially on my own since I was 17. So it was, there was something that was kind of alien about it. I didn't really even realize that it was a dance movie. I figured that I would just dance, you know, and then all of a sudden I saw that there were choreographers and dance doubles and all this kind of stuff.
They didn't audition your dancing?
They did, but it was just kind of like a class. I just took a class and they watched me do this dance class. I had no idea that it was really a dance movie per se. I said to Herb Ross, you don't really need a choreographer, man. I just turn on the music. I love to dance. I'll just dance around for you. I didn't get it. I didn't get it. But all that being said, you know, I took the character very seriously. I thought about him as, you know, coming from a big city and what it would be like to be in a small town and to feel alien to this environment. And, I did all the same work that I would do for anything else. In fact, I went, I got the local high school in Provo, Utah, which is a very heavily Mormon community, to enroll me as a exchange student. And I was concerned. I wanted to see if they would be, if they would think I looked too old, because I was very concerned about playing someone of 17. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to see what it would feel like to be an outsider. Although I had done soaps and I'd done Diner, nobody recognized me. And the teachers, in fact, didn't know, were not in on the scam. It was just the principal of the school and I think maybe the guidance counselor or something. They introduced me as Ren McCormick. And
that's your name in the movie.
Yeah, and that mm-hmm. I was, just like the kid. And it was actually very, very helpful and interesting, terrifying in a lot of ways, you know. I had big guys, you know, threatening to beat me up. And
seriously?
Girls, yeah, and girls, like, you know, giggling and laughing. And, you know, I mean, just, it was very much like the movie. And one kid sort of befriended me, you know, and took me around. And I remember that in the, I think in the script, I was going to go to school. And the mother said to me, if you're going to go to school, you have to put a tie on. And I said, no, Mom, I'm not going to wear a tie. And I knew that that was crazy, that kids in high school didn't wear ties. So that wasn't something that anybody. So we kind of switched it around, and I put the tie on. She said, you're not going to wear that tie, are you? And when I went to the school, I mean, you know, these kids were all farmers and, you know, jocks. And dressed accordingly. And I had sort of like a, you know, punk kind of hairdo and a skinny tie and, you know, kind of a funky looking jacket and stuff like that. And I remember just them looking at me like I was a freak.
You know, when you're in a movie, your face is blown up on a big screen. You're on the cover of magazines. And you have to look at yourself, because I'm sure you have to watch some of the rushes or the movies, if for no other reason than to analyze your performance and see how you did. Does that experience, if for you, has that experience made you any more or less physically self-conscious? And I don't know if you're prone to self-consciousness or not in the first place. Some people are and some people aren't.
Well, let me first say that have you ever left your outgoing message and then played it back and you just cringe? you multiply that by about 1,000, and that's what it's like watching yourself on a movie screen, because it's not just your voice, it's your face, it's your eyes, it's your hair, you know, it's your body. It's very hard to look at yourself in that kind of way. I have spent a lot of time looking at rushes. I started on Footloose, and Herb Ross was very resistant of letting me in, as most directors are, actually, very resistant of letting their actors see their dailies. In fact, I put it in my contract now so that I don't have to have an argument with the director over this. And he finally let me in to, you know, see dailies. And I was, you know, kind of horrified. And I figured that what I needed to do was learn how to get past that and to watch enough footage so that if there was something that I wanted to play, I could learn how to play it, you know, and I could learn things about camera and learn things about camera angles and what plays and what doesn't. Because a lot of times as an actor, you think you're doing something, and then you see it and it doesn't come across that way, and you go, God, I could have sworn I was playing it like this, and it's just not that at all. And I prefer to have some kind of control over that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just kind of throw myself out there and let it turn into whatever it turns into. So I watched and I watched and I watched and I watched, and it did make me, to a certain extent, numb to seeing myself and hearing myself.
Kevin Bacon speaking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's interview with actor Kevin Bacon.
You grew up in Philadelphia.
Yes.
And your father, Edmund Bacon, is a very important person in the city of Philadelphia. And I live in Philly, so I can say that with some authority. I think he was the head of the Planning Commission mm-hmm. for several years.
Yeah.
He designed part of the center city of Philadelphia, and there's even a street named after him mm-hmm. now. And you know, I interviewed him several times when I first got here in the 70s. I'm wondering how it affected your connection to the city of Philadelphia when you were growing up, knowing that your father designed part of it, and that it's like his sensibility was an integral part of your environment.
That's true. But that's not something that necessarily you think about all the time when you're a kid. I mean, my dad used to take me on walks and say, okay, this is going to be, he called them field trips. You know, this area used to be, you know, whatever, burned out. Now there's houses here. We're going to put a greenway through here. And I think that certainly as a kid I was proud of him, and there was an element of celebrity that he had in Philadelphia and still has that I probably aspire to. And it was in some ways formulative to me, because, you know, I think a lot of boys want to beat their father, and, you know, in a way I think I wanted to beat him at the fame game, you know.
Check accomplished.
But not in Philadelphia, though. it's still, hey, Ed. But, you know, that wasn't really a part of my day-to-day life. I mean, I was, whatever, going to school and hanging out with my friends. And the interesting thing is also that my mother, while she lived here with my father, was a New Yorker. And I think that in her own kind of subtle ways, she used to talk to us a lot about New York and how magical it was for her when she was a little girl. And, you know, there's out of six of us, there's three of us there now. So
you didn't go to college. You, after high school, moved to New York so that you could join the Circle in the Square school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a theater and school in New York.
Yeah, it's an acting school. I was in a 2-year program, mm-hmm. and I stayed for a year and then started working.
Did your parents approve of that? Did they think you should go to a school where you'd get your BA?
No, my parents had five kids before me, and they were all around 2 years apart. And 9 years later, I was born. I think they'd pretty much seen it all and done it all. I think their attitude was, whatever you want to do, you'll be all right. And I was a very, very independent kid. I mean, I remember from earliest memories thinking to myself, I got to get out of here and start making my own money and start living on my own, and I don't need help. Came my senior year in high school, and I hadn't really applied to any colleges, and no one had really noticed. And I was able to get out of high school half a year early because of, doing some accelerated thing. And I was working in a book packing warehouse, and I was going to do a play here in Philadelphia for the bicentennial. It was kind of like we were sort of getting together with this group to, kind of write this musical, and it didn't feel like it was going in a good direction. And I heard about a summer program at Circle in the Square. So I went up and auditioned for that, and I was too young to go to their professional workshop, but I begged them if they would just consider me, because I think most of the kids were out of college. And they said, okay, we'll let you audition. I auditioned, I got in. My dad gave me tuition and some money to, look for an apartment. And that was it. I was off to the races. And they never said anything about you need to go to college, you have something to fall back on. It wasn't even discussed.
Were you the youngest kid in the school?
Yes.
Was that a good thing or bad thing?
It was good.
Why?
I'm not sure why, but I think it was good.
It must have been comfortable in the sense you'd been the youngest kid at home.
I've been the youngest kid at home.
It was a role you were familiar with.
I've been the youngest kid at home. I was working in a bar where I was by far the youngest person that was in the bar hanging out. When I was younger, I had almost all of my relationships with women were with women 15, 20 years older than me. And it was just what felt right to me. I don't know.
First film was Animal House. Describe your role in it.
I was a frat boy from the bad guys, the preppy kind of fraternity in the movie. They're sort of like the jerks, elite fraternity.
And what was it like to be on the set? Did you hang out with Belushi? Did you have fun and meet people you wanted to? Did you feel like an outsider?
Well, it was my first movie, and I was so overwhelmed by the process and seeing what actually went into make a movie, and here I was, and I was living in a hotel, and they had this thing called per diem, where they just give you cash every week, and there was a lot of kids, because we were on a campus, so there was, fraternities and girls, and, it was kind of great, in that way. But there was also this dividing line that happened off camera between the actual guys who were in the Animal House and those who weren't. And they had a great sort of fraternity kind of thing going on that was very much like the movie and very exclusive. Belushi wasn't so much a part of that because he was actually shooting for a few days and then flying back and doing Saturday Night Live and then getting back on a plane and shooting for a few days and going back. We were out in Oregon, so it was a long, crazy kind of trip for him back and forth from the set. yeah, I mean, I did feel quite a bit like an outsider. And then when the movie opened, I was working, I was back waiting tables, you know. I mean, I took my money after, you know, came back to New York feeling like a movie star, and I spent all my money in about a week or 2 weeks. And
I know there are so many actors, particularly in New York and probably also in L.A., who are there taking your order, and you know that they're thinking, I'm not really a waiter, I'm an actor.
Uh-huh.
Did
yeah.
you go through that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the restaurant that I worked at, it was an unusual place in that it was not like a real service kind of establishment. It was a place where regulars would go for a shot and a beer and a hamburger. And if you were expecting to, you know, get some ass kissing, you were in the wrong place. And the boss really looked out for the staff, and we looked out for each other. And it was kind of like my first family away from home. You know, it was a family of cops and pimps and drunks and, you know, Wall Street bankers and doctors and lawyers. And, you know, I mean, it was a very kind of diverse group.
Kevin Bacon, speaking with Terry Gross earlier this year. His film The Woodsman is out on DVD. Later this year, Kevin Bacon will star with Colin Firth in Where the Truth Lies, based on the novel by Rupert Holmes. It's the next film from Canadian director Adam Egoyan. That's Liza from the new album, Bill Sharlop Plays George Gershwin. Coming up, some of the non-hits from Hitsville, USA. Rock historian Ed Ward listens to some of the lesser-known singles from Motown. This is Fresh Air. The Motown sound was one of the musical trademarks of the 1960s, yet until now, fans haven't been able to hear anything but its big hits. This has changed with the release of the first volume of The Complete Motown Singles on Hip-O Select, with 11 volumes yet to come. Today, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about Motown's first two hits.
The Motor City, oh, that's the place I'm singing of. Hey, hey, the Motor City, oh, that's the place I'm singing of. Well, I've traveled around from town to town. That is where I met my love. They say down in the south.
There are a lot of myths about Motown Records, which is a shame because the truth is interesting enough. One myth says that it was the first black-owned record company in the United States, which is ridiculous. Black-owned labels date back to Black Swan in the 1920s and continue through the Swing Time and Made in Hollywood labels in the 1940s. Even Chicago's VJ Records, a direct competitor, was already in existence when Berry Gordy started his family of labels. Another myth, which I believed until the other day, was that Motown's first record was a hit, Barrett Strong's Money, That's What I Want. Actually, Motown's first record was a hit, but it wasn't Money. Berry Gordy decided to set up his labels, Tamla, Gordy, and Motown, after producing a number of records and writing a bunch of songs which had done well. He saw others reaping the benefits, so why not do it himself? And so, on January 21st, 1959, Tamla 101 was released. Come to Me by Marv Johnson reached number 6 on the R&B charts and 30 on the pop charts, but not on Tamla. Gordy knew his limitations, and once the record began to sell like crazy in Detroit, he leased it to United Artists. But on this record, we can already hear the Motown sound being born. The whacking tambourine, the perky backup vocals, the fantastic band. There's a good reason for this, too. The band on Come to Me is the Motown house band, the Funk Brothers, in miniature. Bassist James Jamerson and drummer Benny Benjamin are here, as well as guitarists Eddie Willis and Joe Messina, and saxophonist Thomas Beans Bowles, who would lead the Motown touring band in the years to come. Money came out 7 releases later, in August 1959, and it was Barrett Strong's second try for the label. Let's Rock was recorded in a local DJ's basement, and sounds like it. Gordy likely put the record out as a favor to Strong's friend Jackie Wilson, for whom he'd written and produced before starting Motown. Gordy liked Strong's voice and told him to stay in touch. One day, Gordy and Motown's receptionist, Janie Bradford, were fooling around with a piano riff, laughing as they improvised lyrics about how they needed some money. Strong was hanging around and started singing and took over playing the piano. They must have been making a bit of noise because two white kids on their way home from high school heard them and walked in the door. Gordy reemerged to say the studio was set up and the two kids offered to play guitar and bass. Some of the Motown regulars joined them, and the result is history.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need fun. That's what I want.
Your love give me such a thrill, but your love don't pay my bills. I need
Nobody ever saw the two white kids again, but the record they played on became a huge hit, just missing the top slot on the R&B charts. Barry leased money to his big sister's label, Anna, and Motown was on its way.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed the first volume of the complete Motown singles on Hippo Select. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need money. That's what I want.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Universal South, presenting Pages, a new album from the Russian band Bering Strait, available at participating stores, beringstraitonline.com. And from TIAA Cref, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, An American Life in Poetry, we'll meet poet laureate Ted Kooser. For 25 years, he was an insurance executive writing before work every day. He's won the 2005 Pulitzer Prize in poetry. Join us for the next Fresh Air.